Welcome to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast with your host, Steve Abramowitz, editor-in-chief of the Mill Creek View newspaper.
Welcome to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast, episode 50. We are focusing on the volunteer state with always an interesting person making a positive change in our community. This time, special guest John I. Harris. But first, for more information about the Mill Creek View podcast, visit us anywhere you get your podcast and socials at Mill Creek View, Tennessee. While you're there, please subscribe. It helps us keep up on the charts and keep this show free for you. And thanks for doing it, especially Edward of Tennessee Horse Cremation. That's heard them all. Spending 50 hours with us and giving advice on the music and format is a blessing. Thanks, buddy. And you can, too, be writing to me at millcreekview@yahoo.com. Be sure to stay tuned to the end to hear our special 50th edition Best of Steve and Steve segment. And welcome to our People in the News episode, where I interview people who are making an impact and are lovers of truth. Today, we are talking with John Harris. The Tennessee Firearms Association is a Tennessee not-for-profit corporation formed to promote the right to keep and bear arms, restoring government to citizen control, and giving full effect to the original intent of the Bill of Rights to the United States Constitution, as well as the provisions of the Tennessee Constitution, with an emphasis on the Second and Tenth Amendments to the United States Constitution and Article 1, Section 26 of the Tennessee Constitution. The Tennessee Firearms Association is recognized by the IRS as a Section 501c4 entity. It is not a charity. The Tennessee Firearms Association holds that every American is endowed with certain inalienable rights granted to us by our Creator and made our birthright by the sacrifices of the men and women who founded this state and country. The right to keep and bear arms is one of those inalienable rights, one that our government has no authority to infringe or take away, one that our government did not create but merely acknowledges and claims to protect. The Tennessee Firearms Association is dedicated to defending the rights to keep and bear arms. Hello, Mr. Harris. How are you today?
Doing fine. Yourself?
I'm doing great. I'm glad to hear it. Let's just jump right into it. People think Tennessee is the reddest of red states out there. I thought so before I landed here. Most would be surprised to learn our gun laws aren't as liberal as advertised. Governor Lee says that we are one of the constitutional carry states. Do we have a constitutional carry right or not?
Not in Tennessee. There are some states where that clearly does exist. Vermont, for example, and in some of the border states that touch Tennessee. But Tennessee does not now, nor has it ever had constitutional carry in the true meaning of that term.
Now, how did you get involved in all this?
I'm a practicing attorney in Nashville. I've been practicing for 38 years. And when the first shall issue law was adopted in May of 1994, I was in my law practice representing some companies that did security work. And that naturally evolved into being interested in the gun laws that Tennessee had and adopted, outside of just the general interest that a lot of Second Amendment activists have. And so I was one of 12 people that got together and we formed the Tennessee Firearms Association to focus on the nuts and bolts of Tennessee law now that the state had passed a permitting system. And we've been doing that for 28 years.
Yeah. So Tennessee's statutory structure only creates a collection of circumstances which would allow someone to assert to a jury that they are not guilty of the crime of carrying with intent to go unarmed because their actions fit one or more statutory defenses or exceptions. That doesn't sound like a right to carry.
No, it's not. The concept of constitutional carry, and when I started doing this back in the mid-90s, we didn't really use the terminology constitutional carry. We used to talk about Vermont carry. And the reason was, at that time, one state in the nation actually had a constitutional provision in its state constitution that made clear that the individuals in the state had the right to carry a firearm for lawful purposes, predominantly self-defense. But there are other reasons, like, you know, just commuting to and from a gun range. Tennessee's never really had that.
Oh, interesting. So when you began TFA in 1996, the legislature, House, and Senate was in total control of Democrats, like Vermont is now. Now with Republicans in control, which branch is least pro Second Amendment, Senate or the House?
I would say today, with the Republican supermajorities in both the Tennessee House and the Tennessee Senate, that the House has more numerically representatives or elected officials that are pro Second Amendment by far than the Senate does. And I would say that's true proportionately as well, because we've got 99 House members, of which approximately 3/4 of them are Republicans. Yep. And then we've got 33 state senators, and probably 80% plus of those are Republicans. But it's absolutely clear that in either House, there is a minority in the respective Republican caucuses that are true Second Amendment advocates. Otherwise, we wouldn't have the mess we have today.
Interesting. So the whole idea of a red state being pro-gun, not exactly in the Senate. So going back in time, in 1989, late 1900s, Tennessee's legislature rewrote much of the state's criminal code. At that time, it rewrote Tennessee Code 3917-1307. That statute is the one that makes it a crime for anyone to carry a firearm anywhere in the state with the intent to go armed. It was a $50 fine, the Class C misdemeanor, to carry a firearm with the intent to go armed unless you were in a place open to the public where one or more people were present, and then it was a Class A misdemeanor, which carried a $25 fine and up to 11 months, 29 days in jail. Seems like it's going the wrong way.
Oh, absolutely. And that's a good point. What happened in 1989 was the General Assembly sort of did a cleanup on the criminal code in Tennessee, and they recodified large portions of it, including the section that regulates weapons. But Tennessee's gun laws with respect to prohibiting or infringing Second Amendment rights dates all the way back to essentially our founding as a state in 1796. When we can identify statutes that were passed by the very first General Assemblies that started going down this path of if it's a crime to carry a gun in public. And sadly, what was very evident about the laws from 1796 up through the late 1800s is that a lot of those were racially motivated.
Hmm. You mean to keep the guns out of minorities' hands, or to keep guns
predominantly
away from people?
Slaves, former slaves, uh-huh. and the Indian populations.
Uh-huh. So Lieutenant Governor Ron Ramsey, until 2007, there were 14 laws enacted since getting full control of the House and Senate. So it's really incremental in the wrong way, right? That's those 14 laws since 2007 have chipped away at the rights that you're talking about go all the way back to slavery.
Sound
about right? Yeah.
There have been some instances where, given the statutory structure, that changes were made that made minor improvements. It's what they like to refer to, the members of the General Assembly and even our governor, our governors, the last two of them, like to refer to as incremental progress. But it's incremental progress on a fundamental right that the Constitution doesn't even create itself. It just recognizes it and protects it. But there have, in all honesty, been a few situations over the years where statutes progress has been made, but it's you know, progress towards reclaiming a right that never should have been infringed. So is that really progress or not? For example, in 2009 and 2010, this is still when predominantly the Democrats still controlled the House. We were able to pass some legislation that dealt with the statutory prohibition on carrying into restaurants that served alcohol. And the incremental step was that an absolute ban we were able to repeal, but what they substituted was a no consumption standard. So you could go into, say, an old Charlie's or now a Cracker Barrel, even though it sold alcohol for consumption, and you could possess your firearm, assuming it wasn't posted otherwise, but only if you didn't consume any alcohol while you were on the property.
Wow. But they'll let drag queens and minors in. They just won't let gun owners in. Tennessee has a law. I quoted 39.17.1307. This is 39.17.1311. So it must have come soon thereafter. That makes it a crime for anyone to have a firearm in a public park, greenway, campground. When Bill Lee and the Republican-controlled legislature enacted Lee's, quote, permitless carry defense in 2021, they made sure to write it in a way that those who carried under the permitless carry defense would still be subject to criminal prosecution if they carried in a park, greenway, campground, et cetera. Do I have that right?
That is correct. We specifically brought that to their attention as that bill was being negotiated in 2020 and 2021. And keep in mind, this is the bill where our governor, Bill Lee, and several of the House and Senate members that frankly don't know what they're talking about, have declared to the state and others that Tennessee is now a constitutional carry state. And this is the permitless carry law that a federal court agreed order has recently stated in East Tennessee not only violates the Second and 14th Amendments, but it constitutes a federal civil rights violation. That's how atrocious this conduct is that we're seeing from this Republican-controlled supermajority and our Republican governor. But one thing they did specifically is that 1311, which has been on the books for a number of years, it regulates carrying in public parks and recreational facilities. They left it in a status where you have to have a permit, particularly for parks, greenways, campgrounds, places where a lot of Tennesseans that frequent greenways and public parks think mistakenly that now that we have a permitless carry system, that they're able to carry their firearms for self-defense in those areas, and they can't. It's a misdemeanor if they do it, and if certain circumstances exist, it could be, in fact, a felony.
Wow. Yeah, people aren't aware of that. So there's a website out there called Just the News, and it ran a story yesterday, actually, just in time for this interview. Judge strikes down federal gun control law, second major loss for Biden administration in less than a week. Late last week, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals struck down a law banning firearm possession by anyone subject to a garden variety domestic restraining order. The court explained, the question presented in this case is not whether prohibiting the possession of firearms by someone subject to a domestic violence restraining order is a laudable policy goal. Rather, the issue was whether such a rule is constitutional under the Second Amendment of the United States Constitution. The appellate judge found the rule wasn't constitutional. In a separate decision entered yesterday, a different Oklahoma federal judge struck down another law that bans firearms possession by anyone convicted of drug possession. In the case, a man named Jared Harrison was arrested after a routine traffic stop but having some personal marijuana, but no medical card, and was also charged with a more severe federal crime because he had his lawful obtained pistol stowed in the car. The court found the law was unconstitutionally vague, and therefore it ran afoul of the constitutional Second Amendment. To support his ruling, the judge cited last year's Supreme Court decision, NYSRPA versus Bruin. I want to talk about that, which held that U.S. gun regulation must be consistent with the nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation. Saying all that, are Tennessee's laws not in accordance with what the Supreme Court just said regarding Bruin?
Oh, absolutely not. Tennessee, it has got an entire cornucopia of laws, statutes, and regulations that clearly and should be found to be in absolute violation of that new Bruin. Well, it's not really even a new standard, but it's the Bruin standard, which says if the law didn't exist in 1791 or something very close to it, then it's unconstitutional for it to exist today if it infringes the rights that are covered by the broad umbrella recognized by the Second Amendment.
So is TFA expected to carry forward a case on behalf of the gun owners and citizens of Tennessee using the Bruin standard or something to that effect?
Yes. I have been, you know, I volunteer my time for TFA, but I'm also a practicing attorney. And TFA, predominantly through my law practice, is in the process of preparing a lawsuit that would bring the Bruin standard full force against the parks prohibition, the 1311 that we talked about a moment ago.
Awesome. Okay. Well, following up on that one we were just talking about, calling the Biden marijuana law a Trojan horse, the judge explained in his opinion that the framers weren't perfect, but they also weren't fools. If the United States' theory is correct and all a legislature must do to prohibit a group of persons from possessing arms is to declare that group untrustworthy, then the Second Amendment would provide virtually no limit on Congress's discretion. The framers weren't perfect, but they also weren't fools. The framers weren't fools, but there are a lot of fools around. So do you think Tennessee Supreme Court would go for this, or would it have to go all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court and then look back and say Biden was trying to pull a fast one, give Tennessee their freedom with the Second Amendment? How do you foresee it coming out?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, because the Tennessee Constitution, Article 1, Section 26, says that the citizens of the state have the right to keep and bear arms, but the legislature has the right to regulate it with a view towards crime prevention. That clause came on in 1870 to replace a provision right after the Civil War and the enactment of the 13th and 14th Amendments, which had said, the prior Tennessee provision from the 1830s, that it was only the free white men of the state that had a right to keep and bear arms. So what they did was they substituted the racial component with a regulatory authority, they thought. And that, in fact, has existed on the books all the way to today. I mean, it's still there. Hmm. And what's happened is in 2010, the U.S. Supreme Court decided the McDonald decision against the city of Chicago. And the Supreme Court said at that time that Heller's declaration of a individual right by virtue of the 14th Amendment's due process and equal protection clauses would now be fully enforceable against the state. So what happens in Tennessee now is we have a state constitution that indicates that there is a power to regulate the wearing of arms by the General Assembly. But since 2010, that clause, to the extent it exceeds what the Second Amendment permits with its shall not be infringed clause, is unconstitutional as a matter of federal law. And the problem is we've had two governors since 2010, and we've had a whole host of different Republicans in the General Assembly, and the two governors clearly have disregarded the constitutional mandate from McDonald. And most of the members of the General Assembly, including the leadership of the General Assembly, you know, Beth Harwell, Glenn Cassidy, and our current leadership, have just frankly paid it almost no attention. For example, if you look at the fact that the Tennessee Attorney General just signed off on an agreed order in federal court that was filed about 2 weeks ago, concluding that the state's 18 to 20 year old prohibition violates the Second Amendment, violates the 14th Amendment, and constitutes a federal civil rights violation. But yet the leadership in the two houses in the General Assembly, neither one of them are out there saying, hey guys, we've got to, in light of this declaration and consent order by our Attorney General, we've got to look at and repeal some of our existing statutes. I've not heard either the Speaker of the House nor the Lieutenant Governor in the Senate come out and either say that, or if they said it, you know, clarify what they meant. I mean, it's almost as if they're disregarding what the United States Supreme Court said in Bruin.
Interesting. Okay. Well, they're going to find themselves in hot water if they don't pay attention to it. So is transparency in the process a problem, or do you know who is for you and who is against you and what you're trying to accomplish?
Well, I'll give you an example. When the permitless carry law that we opposed, because we said when they were running it, it was unconstitutional. When it was running, we know without a doubt that Lieutenant Governor McNally opposed it in terms of doing what we called at the time real constitutional carry. Mm-hmm. He was sort of comfortable with the governor's proposal because the governor, I think, proposed it, because similar laws had been proposed in the past and they got no traction. And then Lee comes along and proposes what we've got that's already been declared unconstitutional. And then in the House side, Speaker Sexton was interviewed on Nashville radio station at the time back in 2021. And it was because there was a House member that was going to offer an amendment that we were supporting that would have taken the governor's permitless carry law and amended it on the floor to be something more consistent with real constitutional carry. And in that interview on, and we've got it on our website, the speaker indicated that he thought of the 70 plus House Republicans, they would have enough, although not all, to pass the governor's law, version of the law. But he opined that if it was amended to be more like real constitutional carry, that of the, I think, 74 House members that were Republicans, he didn't think they could get at least 50 of them to vote for it. And I think that was probably an accurate assessment, knowing who's in the House back then. Many of them are still there now. The problem is the speaker knows who those people are, and yet there's been no public disclosure from him or his office or even anyone else in House leadership about who is it in the General Assembly that's stonewalling the Tennessee, in Tennessee, the efforts to repeal infringing statutes, regulations, and executive orders. And so if they know who it is, and yet they're more interested in getting them reelected than replaced by real constitutional stewards, we got a structural problem in our General Assembly.
Yeah, and that's the problem with the transparency rules that are up there in Nashville is we don't know. We can't find out. There's nobody on record to say, ah, it's that person. Let's lobby them.
So, well, and it's even worse than that. If you look on our website or search the word Coley, C-O-L-E-Y, on our website, we've got a video clip of a House member who was a committee chairman back several years ago. His name was Jim Coley, and there was a bill up in front of a House subcommittee. Now, the committee only had six members on it, four Republicans and two Democrats, and it was a pro-Second Amendment bill by a House Republican. And when the bill was called for a vote, the House, as a general rule, doesn't require recorded votes. The Senate does. The House didn't, and today I don't think they require recorded votes. They allow the chairman to do a voice vote, and then it's basically the chairman's opinion on which one won. And Coley leaned into the microphone. I mean, we got the video when the vote was taken, and you can see him voting no. And there's a news report that says that initially the vote on that bill was 4-2 to defeat it. Well, that meant two Republicans, and we know who they were. They were Jim Coley and they were John Lundberg. Two Republicans voted no on a pro-gun bill in a subcommittee. The curious part was, and it's documented in this video, that after the vote was taken and the bill was defeated, Coley and Lundberg go to the clerk and change their votes from no, because they weren't recorded votes, they were just voice votes, to present not voting, the effect being that it became a 2-2-2 vote. Let me get rid of that phone call.
Okay.
And so the problem is that even if you have to try to seek transparency, when you go look at voting histories and voting records, the voice votes conceal all of that. And even when it's not concealed, some of them, like Coley, have been allowed to intentionally change their recorded votes. And when Coley was asked about that on the video, he said, yeah, I did it because I didn't want my constituents to know I voted against a gun bill. And the video is right there on our website. That he told a news reporter that, and we were able to get our hands on the news clip before it disappeared.
Oh, that's embarrassing. Okay, so how come you can walk up to Nordstrom's and see a sign saying firearms not allowed if the state allows them? And with respect to gun-free zones, Speaker Sexton thinks that private property rights stand above Second and 14th Amendment rights with respect to who has the power to allow or disallow carry in stores. Do I have that right, too?
Yeah. But matter of fact, Speaker Sexton and Lieutenant Governor McNally have both indicated that they think private property rights take precedent over the Second Amendment. And the problem with that is they don't differentiate between private property rights relative to, say, your home or your residence and private property rights relative to commercial areas, particularly commercial areas that are open to the public, like malls and retail establishments or basically anything that's open to the public. And there are cases, one of which is a case called that we refer to called Ramsey Winch, which says that once you have private property, but you voluntarily make it open to the public, then it's not the same status as private property that's like your personal residence where you can ban anybody for any reason at any time. Once you make it open to the public, all of a sudden you've lost some of those private property right contingencies or aspects. So for example, the civil rights laws kick in. You can't, as a publicly accessible private property owner, ban people based on age, race, sex, religion, or national origin. Those are civil rights violations. So neither of the two speakers are dealing with the nuance between a personal residence and property that's made commercially available to the public on purpose. And there's a huge difference when you look at federal case law on that issue with respect to other rights, particularly the First Amendment.
Right. And if a super sensitive person behind the makeup counter at Nordstrom sees you with that going to the changing room and they call the police, you can be arrested, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's strict liability. If you enter the property under the current statute, which is 3917-1359, if they've got it properly posted and you're in the building, it's strict liability. It's a Class B misdemeanor. It's a $500 fine. You're subject to arrest and upon conviction. A
permit won't prevent.
Forfeiture
a permit won't
weapon.
Help you. A permit won't help you with that.
No, not one bit.
Yeah. So interestingly enough, on Nashville.gov, theft from motor vehicles is huge. Last 3 years, 2,600 versus robberies, only 94. By far the most reported stolen method for guns. People having to leave them in their car make them vulnerable, and they get used in more crimes. 11 blacks, 4 whites, fatal shootings already this year. It's February. Besides safety training, folks need storage training, don't they? If they're not allowed to carry it everywhere they go, they got to stick it in the car to go to Nordstrom's or grocery store that has a sign that says you can't post it, ripe for having it stolen. And that's where the statistics are proving to be happening right here in Nashville, right?
Oh, that is a problem. And the statistics are sort of misleading because they include, for example, situations where the entire vehicle is stolen and there just happens to be a gun in it. And then they include other circumstances where some, frankly, reckless individual leaves their car with the keys in it. Some of them have left the car running and they're leaving firearms in it. But what is clear is a part of the problem is gun-free zones, so that people who, you know, maybe have the ability to carry and they're running their daily errands and they got to go into some store, some establishment that's posted as a gun-free zone. So they got to leave the weapon in the vehicle. That could be eliminated if we change Tennessee's gun-free zone laws and the posting statutes to be more compatible with the fact that we have literally hundreds of thousands of people living here carrying guns. And then you could probably double that number with the visitors from out of state, given our tourism structures.
I've always feared that a gun-free zone is really just an advertisement for a soft target. You know, it hasn't happened here, but it has in plenty of places like Washington, where Steve is, or California, where I came from. There are target-rich environments for those who want to do bad things because they know they're not going to come into resistance, like the Mall of America in Minnesota. So, and one trick, I'm not sure about this in Williamson County or Tennessee, but one trick is they demand classes for permits, but the classes don't really exist, or they're really far away from where most humanity lives, or only once a month, and people have to work, so they can't get to it. So it's not convenient to actually get it done. Is that a thing here?
That's not really a problem here. In Tennessee, the Department of Safety certifies who is eligible to teach the classes, and they write or they supervise the content and the curriculum. It's, if you take the live class with the range training, it's basically about a 5 or 6 hour PowerPoint presentation that the class instructor pretty much just moderates. And then you go to the range and shoot. And then the other one for the concealed only permits, which is a bad idea. We never should have even adopted that law. The training is literally available as a 90-minute online video that you then have to sort of kiosk or oriented. You have to take a test, but it's an online class you could take on your cell phone practically. So getting access to the classes isn't really a problem in Tennessee. It's getting through the hurdles to take the class, make the appointment, get your fingerprints done, go have your photo done, and then apply and wait. You know, but compared to states like New York and California, it's probably a lot better process to get the permit.
But and they all are infringements technically, because they're making the friction on the path to actually being able to do something we have a right to do. Now, Governor Lee signed, as we said, and Democrats claimed that the permitless carry law would lead to a spike in gun violence. Were they right, or have they been proven wrong?
You know, I don't subscribe to the idea, and I'm not seeing conclusive data to indicate that it has done that. The permitless carry law may have made it more convenient or easier for people to carry, particularly people that didn't want their name in some kind of government database tied to a permit. But frankly, the people that are committing the crimes, they didn't care about the permit law in the first place.
Right.
You know, they're stealing the guns. They're using them intentionally to engage in criminal conduct. Now, sure, there's going to be some quantity of situations where just the physical availability of the gun and maybe a road rage kind of situation might contribute to an alleged assault. But that, you know, that's likely was going to happen anyhow. I just don't see the data that supports the conclusion as opposed to the coincidence that allowing more people to carry has increased violent crime. And my general appreciation of the issue is that John Lott and the Crime Prevention Research Center, their studies disprove that.
Yeah. And I still think that law-abiding citizens who get their guns stolen create a crime of opportunity when somebody who has a gun now all of a sudden can go out and actually steal something and usually not knowing what they're doing cause harm to people. So we agree, and it's black and white. The Second Amendment says shall not be infringed. In contrast, it is important to understand that under Tennessee law, the entire state is defined as a gun-free zone, including all personal real property by Tennessee Code 3917-1307A1. The fact that your home, your farm, your place of business are defined as gun-free zones for you by the state is proven by the fact that state law makes it an affirmative defense and puts the burden on you to prove that you on your own property or in your own home at the time that you are carrying a firearm with the intent to go armed, 3917-1308, you, TFA, Tennessee Firearm Association, is the only full-time organization supporting the right to keep, bear, and wear arms for Tennesseans. Your presence in the Capitol works for us, but the coordinated effort of tens of thousands of individual gun owners is more important and significant, you write. Why should gun owners join TFA?
Well, that's a great question. And I'll put it like this, you know. We want you to support and join TFA because you want to contribute and support the effort. Okay. It's not like some organizations where unless you pay your dues, you don't get the information. We give the same information to dues paying members that we give to the general public. You don't have to be a member to get the benefit of what TFA does. You know, our perspective is that if you get the information and you agree with what we do, the advocacy that we bring, the efforts that we make, that you're going to want to financially contribute to it because it is, in fact, a grassroots organization, and you like the effort and the accomplishment. And in fact, if you look on our website, you'll see several years of both resolutions and proclamations by the General Assembly up until the time basically that the Republicans took control, where even the General Assembly was recognizing the TFA and at times the Democrats in the General Assembly for the hard work that we've done to try to represent the interests of Tennesseans on Second Amendment issues. And so the other thing is TFA helps Second Amendment advocates in the state be force multipliers. So for example, through our resources, which are basically contributed monies from members, you know, we've put online this year a letter writing tool, which lets you easily send emails, tweets, and even phone calls to your specific elected official. And also this year, uniquely, when we have a bill coming up in a particular committee or subcommittee, we have the ability with this tool to let everybody across the state target all of those committee members.
That's great.
Yeah, that's not something that the individual, well, they can do it without the existence of an organization like TFA, but it is so much easier with an organization like TFA there to provide those resources. That, I mean, it, you know, frankly, the resource that we're talking about costs about $7,500 a year. Well, a handful of activists acting on their own aren't going to afford that.
Right.
But when we've got tens of thousands of members, you know, it's an economy of scale that we can do a lot more by working together than we can accomplish, you know, working autonomously, independently.
Yeah, it's a great grassroots organization. You also maintain a list of locations that ban firearms, like we talked about Nordstrom's. Find out
when they're reported to us, we publish it. That's right.
To find out who doesn't respect your liberty and doesn't want or deserve your money. Basically, this information is updated and supported by the registered users of the TFA forum. And you provide a resource to clarify misinformation in the media. That's important, too.
Yeah, we do. We accept every public speaking request that we receive. So we will do interviews like this. In addition, we frequently, the board members do, travel to speak with local groups, GOP groups, Democrat groups, civic interest groups, conservative groups. You know, I speak pretty regularly at colleges, campuses even.
That's great.
To their conservatives on campus. And so it's a great resource, and it's a purpose driven resource by volunteers. Another thing that your listeners need to understand is TFA being a state grassroots group, all the money we raise stays in Tennessee. TFA is driven by volunteers at the executive and board member level. So memberships aren't going to pay some guy $1 million salary that likes to fly on private jets. The money stays here for benefit purposes. And we also, in addition to TFA, there's another organization called TFA LAC, Tennessee Firearms Association Legislative Action Committee, which is a state level PAC. And so, for example, our annual event in 2022, which was in September, and it'll be September again this year, we grossed about $85,000 in revenue between the event, the ticket sales at the event, donor sponsorships, and auctions. But we netted about $65,000, and all of that money goes to support campaigns and candidates for the state legislature predominantly.
Nice. So Fast forward to today. On January 23rd, 2023, the state of Tennessee, under the leadership of Attorney General Jonathan Scarametti, our new guy, entered into an agreed order which concluded that laws enacted by the Tennessee legislature under a Republican supermajority constitute an unconstitutional scheme that had the effect of denying 18 to 20-year-olds the opportunity to get a handgun permit or carry under the 2021 permitless carry law. Governor Lee appointed AG Scarametti. Is he a gun right proponent of yours?
Well, Scarametti is actually in Tennessee appointed by the Tennessee Supreme Court. The governor didn't have anything to do with it.
Okay.
But he has, compared to the attorney generals we've had in the last three decades that I've dealt with, he has shown so far to be above and beyond the others in terms of recognizing the fact that the Second Amendment means something. And it has to be the litmus test by which the constitutional validity of state statutes, executive orders, and regulations are measured. And he's shown the boldness that he actually entered into that proposed agreed order in the Beeler case, which is the one you're referring to, and stipulated that Tennessee's gun law, as carried and proudly proclaimed by our governor to be constitutional carry, is in fact unconstitutional and constitutes a federal civil rights violation with respect to 18 to 20 year olds.
It's going to have to end up in the courts, unfortunately. We got about 5 minutes left. I got a page worth of questions. I only get to ask a couple of them. So in Nashville this session, there are 67 bills that have been identified for tracking. By your group, several of those bills are caption bills, which appear to do insignificant or immaterial things, but they were selected because they indicate the intent to amend many portions of the existing statutes, including the ones where firearms related legislation typically exists, Title 39. Anything particularly egregious you're watching?
Well, there's always some bills put in by legislators that have no clue what the Second Amendment stands for, and legislators that, you know, just boldly ignore Thomas's statements in that Bruin decision that the balancing of state interest was made when they adopted the Second Amendment in 1791 and said shall not be infringed. Past that date, there is no constitutional basis for any means balancing or reasonableness analysis of a restriction. If it's a restriction, it's unconstitutional. They just ignore that on both sides. I mean, it's not just the Democrats. It's both sides, and it's a wholesale disregard of that oath that they take to uphold the Constitution. So we're watching. You're right. We do watch those bills. That's part of the information that we put out for free. I mean, it costs us a lot of money to monitor them because we subscribe to some services, but the members value it enough, you know, that they chip in and help pay for it. And we hope it's sort of like going to church. You know, we want people to put the money into the contribution plate because they appreciate what we're trying to accomplish, not because we're sending them a bill and saying you owe it just because we exist. And it's really a very close analog to what TFA is trying to do. Is we're giving you all the information. We're doing everything we can, and we want you to chip into the collection plate, so to speak, with a membership, because you also support the goals and agendas.
Yeah, I got mine the day I got my driver's license. There are 9 hearings this week, the week of February 21st, that will deal with various Second Amendment-related bills in the House and Senate. That's ominous. Which one or two should we be looking at, or should we be writing anybody? I know you've endorsed folks like, what do my notes here say? You would vote, you had Mark Green at your annual event in September, you mentioned. You have Bruce Griffey and Jerry Sexton. They deserve thanks for being on your side. Is there anybody we should be, Adam Lowe, you endorsed, he won for Senate. Rusty Crow, Don White, I think also won. Is there anybody we should be emailing to say, look out for this bill in February that is infringing on our rights to bear arms?
Yeah, we will. As soon as the calendars are released and we've done our review and talked to them about are they offering amendments, we will be putting out an email alert, usually on Fridays, as those hearing calendars get finalized of which bills we're recommending people contact and support, which ones we, you know, we recommend they contact and oppose. I mean, we've got certain House members in particular, I mean, you look at that we find are consistently strong. It's people like Clay Doggett, Rusty Grills, Chris Todd, Jay Reedy, you know, and I know I'm leaving some people out, but those are just some that I've had conversations with, or we've had conversations with just in the last day or two, that we know have some of these caption bills. They're working on amendments, and they're amendments that we think are going in the right direction. And we think it's still an uphill battle. And the reason is the leadership isn't seeing the constitutional urgency to deal with the fact that we have clearly unconstitutional laws in the state. That's their fault, because they either passed them in the last 13 years, or they have repeatedly refused efforts through filed legislation to repeal them. And either way, it's a breach of their oath of office to not take action when we're talking about constitutional infringements.
We didn't even get into the idea of what the federal government has in store for us.
Yeah, we got a big enough plate just trying to deal with Tennessee. You know, we've got Gun Owners of America, Second Amendment Foundation, and a few other, but not all of the national groups that are on the right warpath, so to speak, with respect to the federal stuff.
And the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation, division of, I guess, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, HB 2509, House Criminal Practices Subcommittee. The intent of the bill is simple. It would be to remove a short barrel rifle and a short barrel shotgun as a prohibited firearm under Tennessee law. But David Rausch, who is the director of the TBI, is opposing that. So there they are, putting their nose in our business. We are out of time here. I love this quote on your website. Tennessee Firearms Association believes that when citizens are armed, they are better able to defend themselves, their families, and their properties from criminals, and the crime data supports that conclusion. John, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. We are at the end here. Please tell my listeners where they can go to find out more about you and TFA.
Absolutely. The first source I would send you to is just the website, TennesseeFirearms.com. That's Tennessee, all spelled out, firearms, all spelled out, .com. So that's the first place I would refer them to. We do have a Twitter feed. It's used mainly. It's, again, Tennessee Firearms, to post links as we put out press releases and our weekly updates. We also have an extremely active Facebook group that's got about 11,000 active participants in it. And it's a great resource for anybody to go to and ask questions. And what we do that makes it a little different is we've got a team of moderators, and we try to actively restrict posts on that site to topics that are Second Amendment relevant, because there's a gazillion Facebook groups that talk about the federal stuff. So we try to keep the Tennessee Firearms Association Facebook group sort of focused on Tennessee relevant issues. Now, there's some stuff that's got broad appeal that gets in anyhow, but we do try to restrict it to Tennessee relevant stuff. So you've got the website, TennesseeFirearms.com. You've got the Facebook group, and I actively engage in and monitor the Facebook group myself. And we impose rules on it. For example, if you're going to come on there and express an opinion about the law, you better have a statute or a case to back it up, or we will literally take the post down.
Very cool. We will attach that to our show notes. Thanks again for coming on with us.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Awesome. I don't understand how you ever did without me. I don't understand. Welcome to the Steve and Steve segment of our show, where we cover what we just heard. Mr. Steve, what did you think of our guest, John I. Harris?
Oh, I enjoyed that. I learned a lot. I learned that Tennessee reacted way back in the 1890 or 1790s, and then in the 18, whenever it was, because, hey, we just had a war, and now we're going to have another war, and now there was a reaction, a backlash, and here it is. They're trying to stay to the Constitution, according to John, but it's kind of like time to upgrade and make it equal so it actually reflects the Constitution of the United States.
That's right. No longer reconstruction where the Confederates have to be put on their heels. It's time to bring everybody in line with the Constitution for all.
Yes.
Justice for all. So this is our 50th episode in Tennessee.
Woohoo!
Hard to believe. So in honor of our golden anniversary, 50th is gold, producer Steve slaved away over all that content to bring you our best of the ever popular Steve and Steve segment of the show. I haven't heard this yet, so let's listen in and be reminded of our time together.
Well, last week's check.
Welcome to the new Steve and Steve segment of our show. Producer Steve and I are going to talk about what we just heard and something I have on my mind, where we cover the latest happenings and issues of our day. So, pretty great interview, don't you think, Steve?
Oh, I really enjoyed it. This guy knows his stuff, and Steve, it's like two peas in a pod, you and Gary. I mean, I think having you there in Tennessee and having him, and he launched in January, and you launched this year as well. I think I find that's very cool, don't you?
It is, because, you know, I know where they went off the rails in Washington, where you sit, and now I'm looking at it from the perspective here, and Gary certainly is the one advocating for the, you know, pro-America patriotic thing. Actually, I wanted to talk to you about the governor here versus the governor there.
Right.
Today, Governor Bill Lee put out a day of prayer, humility, and fasting in Tennessee and encourages all citizens to join me in this worthy observance. And it has a lot to do with what's happening at Vanderbilt University, where they are basically on tape under an investigative journalism's video showing that they would rather take $100,000 to $200,000 for bottom surgery for youth under age 18 all the way down to, well, really no age.
It's been a theme of ours, hasn't it?
Or top surgery, unfortunately, is only $20,000 for these guys. And they've been doing it for 4 years. At the same time, the state legislature had a bill on the books that could have done away with this, but until it became a crisis that was exposed by media, it stayed in the shadows until today. And now they're going to talk about an emergency session because they can't wait until next 2023 session to actually do something, because the victims are obviously stacking up. So on my mind today, here in Tennessee, a group of Tennessee Republican lawmakers have sent a letter to the Vanderbilt University Medical Center, basically saying, while those 18 years and older are recognized as legal adults and free to make decisions in their best interest, it is an egregious error of judgment that an institution as highly respected as Vanderbilt would condone and promote harmful and irreversible procedures for minor children in the name of profit. Vanderbilt Pediatric Transgender Clinic's practices qualify as nothing less than child abuse, the letter says. Further, we are appalled that these reports demonstrate threats by Vanderbilt personnel to take adverse action against employees who are conscientious and religious objectors to genital disfiguring and double mastectomies of children. The same day, Steve, Seattle Children's Hospital stated, Seattle Children's is the only pediatric academy medical center with fellowship-trained plastic surgeons who provide gender-affirming surgery in our region, Washington, Wyoming, Alaska, Montana, and Idaho, the website says. We treat teens and young adults who are patients of Seattle Children's Gender Clinic. We also accept patients who are receiving gender-affirming care through providers outside of Seattle Children's. This all stems from a new law that health insurers must cover gender-affirming care, including surgical treatments that were previously denied coverage. Democrats rejected a proposal to apply the new law to patients over 18 years old. It's one in a series of new laws that's taken together allow children as young as 13 years old to make serious health care decisions. The consequences are immense. That's a Washington law I'm talking about, SB 5889. What do you think of that, Steve?
Well, Marco Elias, a Democrat from, my little town of Linwood, has been a purveyor of this for years, and he pushed for the bill. It got through, and basically it forces companies or insurance companies to pay for teen surgeries without parental notice, because there's a whole combination of bills that have been through. And of course, our illustrious tyrant, Mr. Inslee, pushed, signed them into a legislation. I just recognize how satanic, and I use that term, to be honest, directly towards Marco and all the others down there in my Washington state legislation. These people are evil. They under the name of compassion, are doing this, and there's anything but compassion when you're dealing with someone who's under 18, who's emotionally easily manipulated. And quite frankly, I've done enough research to know that anybody who has gender issues has been most likely terribly, terribly abused since they were children, and now or in a very abusive situation, family destructive environment. And they are not in a position to make these kind of decisions, and they need to be actually counseled and assisted to help them clarify what is at the core of these feelings. And I think you will find a lot of them are just screaming out for help. And instead of getting help, they're getting sent to a living hell. Because once you go down this track, it's hard to replace. Steve, once you've had these surgeries, you can't go back.
It's irreversible. And just like James's story reminds me of the city council member who might shut down a little girl's lemonade stand for not having the correct permits in place or whatnot. This, I have to say, I'm happy that the Tennessee legislature is willing to take a stand. I'm very, very disappointed that this Washington is the exact opposite. But here's where it gets even worse.
It's an act of medical censorship for sure. Dan, I had thousands of posted, basically graphical abstracts of peer-reviewed papers. It just was the science. It was bringing late-breaking science to the community, and people followed me all over the world. This is coming on the heels of California AB 2098, which was signed into law, which is the Dr. Muzzle law in California.
So for those who don't know that voice, and they should, it should be the most noticeable voice in the history of humanity, but that was Dr. Peter McCullough, absolutely the smartest virologist living today on this planet. He also said, now we have hundreds of manuscripts published on myocarditis heart inflammation, indicating a recent report that found a higher risk for young people after COVID-19 vaccination than after COVID-19 itself, as well as autopsies conducted on fatal cases of heart inflammation, some of which have suggested a causal link between the issues and the vaccines. So when we see young people now dying, unexpectedly dying, either during sports or during sleep, in my view, it should be considered COVID-19 subclinical myocarditis and sudden cardiac death until proven otherwise. Again, a genius said this. Also, the same day as Representative Democratic Illinois Sean Casten tweeted about his own daughter, Florida Surgeon General, oh, by the way, Twitter knocked him off for that, Dr. McCullough. The same day, Florida Surgeon General Joseph Lapado, referencing an analysis the Florida Department of Health conducted, announced that the agency is advising against messenger RNA, mRNA, COVID-19 vaccines for men aged 18 to 39. He said, Florida will not be silent on the truth. Today, we release an analysis on COVID-19 mRNA vaccines the public needs to be aware of. This analysis showed an increased risk of cardiac-related death among men 18 to 39. Florida will not be silent on the truth. That was his tweet, which he was canceled for, and then out of uproar, they ended up putting it back on there. Twitter tried to cancel both of these people. Would you play the second clip, please?
Was the Pfizer COVID vaccine tested on stopping the transmission of the virus before it entered the market?
Regarding the question around, did we know about stopping immunization before it's entered the market? No. We had to really move at the speed of science to really understand what is taking place in the market.
beat of science.
This is scandalous. Millions of people worldwide felt forced to get vaccinated because of the myth that you do it for others. Now, this turned out to be a cheap lie.
Yep.
And then 100%. Finally, I just want to say, so we've heard from a Surgeon General of a state of America. We've heard from the most brilliant doctor going during the crisis of COVID. The CDC, the U.S., taxpayer-funded Center for Disease Control and Prevention, who led the bus on all, drove the bus on all of this, will not release its review of post-COVID-19 vaccination heart inflammation. The CDC has been performing abstractions on reports of post-vaccination myocarditis, a form of heart inflammation submitted to the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, but the agency is saying that federal law prevents it from releasing the results. Steve, producer Steve, my question to you is, have we been lied to for 2.5 years?
Get my book, Breaking the Deception Code. Yes, we have been lied to for day one. They've known from day one that this stuff was deadly. And they also knew that the COVID flu, in Fauci's own words in the New England Journal, I think it came out in February of 2020, was no different than any other flu. But the point is, yeah, these shots are called clot shots for a reason. And we have yet to see the long-term play out of this. I happen to know somebody who's 28 years old, and she is dead now. We firmly believe because she took the shots, and there's no other history in her family of a brain hemorrhage and stroke and all that she went through when she died.
We're hearing about that on a daily basis now. Athletes are just stacking up, and you know, somebody's going to have to pay for this. And the truth is coming out, and that's what this show is dedicated to, is truth, and has been since day one. And so that's why I played all that, because I want people to know. Welcome to the Steve and Steve segment of our show, where we cover what we just heard and anything else on our minds. Steve, Lori Cardoza Moore, what'd you think of that?
Well, I really, that was a very, very interesting interview, and she has her hands in a lot of different things, trying to make a point of seeing that they're godless people. I call them darklings in my book, who really hate God and hate human beings. And I want to read a little scripture here. It says in Psalms 2, "Why do the nations rage and the peoples plan in vain? The kings of the earth take their stand, and the rulers gather together against the Lord and against the Anointed One. Let us break their chains, they say, and throw off their fetters." We know that Bill Gates is as lost can be, and that's why he does what he does.
Amen. Okay. Well, moving on, I suppose. It's hard to beat that, but let's go to the next segment here. Welcome to the Steve and Steve segment of our show, where we cover what we just heard. Producer Steve, what'd you think of our guest, California teacher Larry Sand?
Larry knows his stuff, and you had a lot of information that you rattled off there, and I think sometimes he was like, am I tracking what you're saying? But Larry is I like it when somebody who's come from the swamp, who walks out of the swamp, looks back and go, oh my gosh, and is now doing something to clean it up and to build awareness. And that's what Larry and his organization is doing. He's building awareness, and he's saying, that's two guests now, Steve, yesterday and today. They both said, if I had kids at childhood age of school age, I would pull them out of the public schools. And I've said the same thing. If my boys now were at that age, I'd homeschool and or private school. They would not be in public.
And two professionals in the business of education to say such a thing means we got a serious problem. That good segue into how we got here. So I just want to do a little segment. Everyone always asks me, like, why are you so against this person? What's so bad? Well, let's take a listen.
Where's the education pieces here? Where's the education pieces here? Climate change.
Your favorite person.
Actually stop these extreme weather events.
Chalkboard.
Look at what's happening
nails.
In Kentucky right now. Look at what's happening in California right now. We then give a future to our kids. This
Thank
is a
you.
Bill that's going to solve the issues that keep people up at night. Thank you very much.
So first of all, I don't know why she's screaming. That just sounds
shrill.
Oh,
she's jumping up and down and just...
Welcome to the Steve and Steve segment of our show, where we cover what was just heard. Producer Steve, what did you think of our guest, Aaron T. Miller at Foundation for Liberty and Freedom?
It's refreshing, Steve, to find people like Aaron and his team who, at this young age, I would take him to be in his 30s, at the oldest, is tackling such issues and seeing a need, and who's coming from a grounded family, and his whole team is coming from God, country, family mindset, and they want to take back our country, and they want to bring a semblance of sanity and godliness and freedom to it, and they're starting out with teaching kids, teaching adults, instructing young adults, and then supporting them to go and learn how to be tomorrow's leaders. And there's a couple other organizations I know of that are doing that, but these guys are doing it on their own. And again, Steve, great guest. And boy, these guys just started out and they're already doing some wonderful things.
They are. It reminds me of the Silent Majority Foundation. And what you said, taking back our country, that is so key to remember what that phrase means. What are we taking our country back from? And the idea that the institutions have been so, so overwhelmed with a communist, Marxist, call it what you want, socialist mindset, all we're doing is trying to take it back to the origins that were built on liberty, freedom, patriotism, love of country, love of our people, our individualism. It's the only country in the history of the universe that was founded on liberty. That's a good thing. We don't want repressive communism or Marxism in our schools or in our children's heads at all.
Well, last week's check.
Welcome.
Well, what do you think, Steve?
I think you did a great job. Thank you very much. That has been a pleasure. Sounded good. Reminds me of a lot of fond memories of doing this show. And so thanks for putting that together. Appreciate it for our 50th episode. For those of you who have stuck with us this long, stay tuned for my thought of the week. Thanks for that walk down Mill Creek View memory lane, producer Steve, and welcome to my thought of the week. But before I share, I want to remind everyone to subscribe to the Mill Creek View podcast so you can hear more stories like that. Just go to Rumble or Spotify and hit the subscribe button and follow us. And thanks for doing it. The rifle itself has no moral stature. Since it has no will of its own, naturally, it may be used by evil men for evil purposes, but there are more evil men than evil. And while the latter cannot be pursued to the path of righteousness by propaganda, they can certainly be corrected by good men with rifles. Jeff Cooper, Art of the Rifle. The great body of our citizens shoot less as time goes on. We should encourage rifle practice among schoolboys and indeed among all classes, as well as in the military services by every means in our power. Thus, and not otherwise, may we be able to assist in preserving peace in the world. The first step in the direction of preparation to avert war if possible, and to be fit for war if it should come, is to teach them to shoot. Theodore Roosevelt. If you take guns away from legal gun owners, then the only people who would have guns would be the bad guys. Bruce Willis. I have a very strict gun control policy. If there's a gun around, I want to be in control of it. Clint Eastwood. That's it for this 50th episode. Really hoped you liked it. Thank you, John I. Harris, for standing up for our constitutional inalienable rights to bear arms. Thank you, producer Steve, for making this show high quality. Until next time, this is your host, Steve Abramowitz, editor-in-chief of the Mill Creek View newspaper. Peace in our time.
County Fair. They were looking for America behind every turn, flying the very colors that so many love to burn. I'll cruise the countryside with my dad and my brother, row after row.
Any views or opinions represented on the podcast are personal and belong solely to the creator and do not represent those of people, institutions, or organizations that the creator may or may not be associated with in a professional or personal capacity unless explicitly stated.